Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we ask the following question. What do you want to know about the 2022 report on FINRA's examination and risk monitoring program? On this episode of the Compliance in Context podcast, we explore the hidden nuances and key differences in the new FINRA report with Susan Schroeder, former head of enforcement at FINRA and current partner at WilmerHale, who sits down with us to review the report and the impact on compliance professionals everywhere. In our headline section, we look at the recently released annual priorities issued by the SEC Division of Examinations. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of History Has Your Back, where we look at the legendary Kung Fu martial artist Bruce Lee and a quote to help inspire you and hopefully provide peace of mind for securities compliance professionals everywhere. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, the SEC Division of Examinations recently released its annual priorities, which include an increased focus on private funds, ESG risks, cybersecurity and operational redundancy, and crypto assets. In the report, the division stated that it will focus on, among other things, specifically in the private fund space, ensuring registered investment advisors comply with fiduciary duties, evaluating risks related to compliance guidelines, management fees and expenditures, custody of assets, financial audits, asset appraisal, conflicts of interest, investment risk disclosures, and safeguards pertaining to important non-public information. And finally, in the private fund space, they talked about reviewing investment strategies, risk management controls, and customer recommendation practices to identify, quote, conflicts and disclosures, end quote, in areas of, quote, systemic importance. On the ESG front, the SEC noted they're looking to ensure that ESG investing methodologies are properly disclosed and that policies, procedures, and practices are implemented to avoid breaches of federal securities laws. They're going to be reviewing how client securities are voted to determine if voting is in line with ESG mandates, looking at examining portfolio selections to find ESG misrepresentations or inconsistencies. And on the retail investors front, the Division of Examinations noted they're looking to confirm compliance with the Advisors Act and Reg BI by evaluating investment strategies, conflict management, and account management, including account selection, conversions, and DOL fiduciary rule, persons that have to follow that rule, IRA rollovers, to determine actions taken are in the best interest of retail investors. On the information security and operational redundancy front, the SEC Division of Examinations noted they're going to be looking at reviewing how firms protect customer information, specifically preventing breaches and addressing threats from malicious email schemes, ransomware attacks, and identity theft situations. They're also going to be assessing firm controls over vendor and service provider selection. And finally, they're going to be looking at ensuring firms have business continuity plans that adequately consider climate-related risks. Finally, another area they talked about was the new technology and crypto asset space, where they talked about they're going to be looking at evaluating new products, services, and practices to determine whether the operations and controls used are in line with the claims made to investors and meet the standard of conduct owed to investors and other regulatory obligations. They're also going to be reviewing investments recommendations, including those made by algorithms, to ensure they reflect investors' chosen strategy and meet the standard of conduct owed to such investors. They're also going to be ensuring firm controls adequately consider certain unique risks associated with emerging technologies and assessing investments in crypto, including things related to trading activities, recommendations, and custodial arrangements. What's the key takeaway here? Well, I think to start, there are a couple of items from the foreword itself that I'd really want to highlight. The division completed over 3,000 examinations in fiscal year 2021, 3040 to be exact, which was a 3% increase from fiscal year 2020 and about on par with the pre-COVID-19 pandemic examination totals in fiscal year 2019. During fiscal year 2021, the division issued more than 2,100 deficiency letters. And to date, the SEC's fiscal 2021 examinations have prompted firms to return more than $45 million to investors. There also appeared to be a little bit of a shot across the bow, I'll call it. I don't know, a very material statement made, although it could have gotten lost if you weren't exactly on the lookout for it, where the SEC said, quote, as the primary and often only regulator responsible for the oversight of this cohort of registrants, meaning investment advisors and investment companies, we closely track our coverage ratio and have targeted it to be 15% for the last several years. This year, the division examined approximately 16% of RIAs, compared to 15% in fiscal year 2020 and fiscal year 2019. Although there was a slight increase in the coverage percentage in fiscal year 2021, we will likely soon have to lower our annual coverage target as the growth in the number of RIAs continues to grow at a rate that far outpaces staffing increases. In fiscal year 2021, we saw some of the fastest year-over-year growth ever with a net addition of approximately 900 RIAs. And over the last 5 years, the number of RIAs has increased 20%, from approximately 12,250 to over 14,800. The growth in the numbers of RIAs does not fully capture the increasing complexity of the asset management industry and the resulting increased complexity of the compliance issues and risk covered by our examinations. For instance, the number of RIAs with AUM over $10 billion has increased by 30% in the past 5 years alone, and total AUM is now over $113 trillion, itself a nearly 70% increase from 5 years ago. In addition, approximately 60% of RIAs are affiliated with other financial industry firms, more than 35% manage a private fund, end quote. I don't know if others listening to this podcast get the same feeling that I do from reading that quote, but it definitely feels like the SEC is kind of standing up and saying, hey, if you want us to keep doing all this stuff, we're going to need more resources. Certainly if we're going to keep the same kind of target percentages that we've had in the past. And there has been talk over the years about having an SRO established for investment advisors, just like there is for the broker-dealer industry. And I would imagine many of the listeners to this podcast would have pretty strong feelings against that concept. So let us hope that the SEC continues to get the resources it needs to perform its valuable service to the investment advisor industry. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to welcome in Ms. Susan Schroeder to lead us through a conversation looking at the 2022 report on FINRA's examination and risk monitoring program. Susan is the former head of enforcement and management committee member at FINRA. Susan has deep insight into the priorities and procedures of the regulatory bodies that govern the financial services industry, including U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, FINRA exchanges, state securities regulators, etc. In addition, Ms. Schroeder calls on her extensive experience overseeing thousands of regulatory investigations to help assist and advise clients in all aspects of internal investigations, including detecting potential misconduct, complying with reporting obligations, and effectively remediating any kind of systemic problems. While at FINRA, Ms. Schroeder prioritized coordination with other financial regulators to minimize costly and inefficient regulatory duplication. She helped lead the transformation of FINRA's enforcement program to create a more unified department with clear priorities and was the primary architect of FINRA's updated policy regarding cooperation credit. She has in-depth experience regarding supervisory and anti-money laundering violations, market access, market conduct rules, customer protection, and the list goes on and on. We are incredibly pleased to welcome Ms. Susan Schroeder to the show today. She's currently back at WilmerHale, which I believe is where she may have done some time earlier in her career. Thank you so much for joining us today, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So as we kind of kick off, I know FINRA's 2022 report on the examination and risk monitoring program came out just a couple weeks ago. And I think it would be great if you would share with us, you know, as you looked at the report and given some of your prior roles, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these. And so, you know, what are some high level thoughts that you have on the report? Maybe, a couple key subject matter areas that, you know, stood out to you.
Yeah, at a really high level, my reaction to the report when I read it was that the report reflects the enormous amount of innovation and disruption that is rippling throughout the industry, right? I think we've all heard a lot about new business models through fintech businesses, for example, that are changing the way people invest, changing the shape of investment relationships. And you can see some themes in the FINRA priorities around innovation, technology, and change. I think one of the things you can also see emerging is the fact that FINRA's rules are not written for the way business is done today. And some of their observations and some of their priorities really reflect a disconnect between rules that might be 70 years old and practices that are very 2022. So it'll be interesting to see how FINRA navigates some of that challenge.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, one of the areas in particular that I found interesting in the report really related to kind of some of those key firm operations, and especially on like the anti-money laundering side. Obviously, this is, you know, becoming an increasing concern for FINRA. Certainly, they've, you know, shared some high-level thoughts on some parts of the firm's AML program that, you know, I think it's FINRA Rule 3310 that requires firms to, you know, establish and implement policies and procedures and internal controls that can help detect that activity. But, you know, as you were looking in some of that section, you know, were there any particular subject matter areas or key questions inside there that also kind of stood out to you?
Yeah, one key question that stood out to me is something of a perennial favorite in the AML space for FINRA and for the SEC to some degree. It's one of the first questions FINRA asks. It says, has your firm experienced substantial growth or changes to its business? If so, has its AML program reasonably grown and evolved? And that is a theme. That is a theme we've seen in large AML cases at FINRA for years now. This theme that a business grows and doesn't grow its program commensurate with its footprint. Now, if you look at the older cases, you might have seen a business that grew through acquisition, right? Or a business line that was introduced and the AML program didn't pivot, right, to conform to a new business line. I think now, though, a lot of the challenge you'll see across the industry is that the industry has grown, right? With the proliferation of new technologies, with people doing app-based trading on their phones, you see events like the GameStop event last year, where the amount of trading that is conducted in a single day just eclipses previous records. And it's not that a single firm has grown too fast. It's that the industry has grown enormously. The number of transactions have grown enormously. And when that is the case, it's not so much a matter of, listen, this firm failed to hire twice as many compliance people when they hired twice as many registered reps, right? It's a much more complicated and industry-wide problem to deal with this you know, exponential growth in trading. And how does the industry as a whole respond reasonably to that? FINRA seems to continue to signal that it expects firms to foresee, you know, the trading of the future and be equipped, you know, have armies of people waiting in the AML program to start reviewing trades when they happen. And that's not realistic. It's an industry-wide problem. So that's one thing that really jumped out to me about the way FINRA is thinking about AML and some of the worry I have there.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And you know, absent firms hiring soothsayers as their next, you know, the next key employees at the firm, that would be a really difficult challenge to try to build the proper resources around that particular aspect. I don't know. I mean, either, I guess one follow-up question might be, you know, what if you had a firm and you know that they're trying to accomplish that feat of trying to stay ahead of it, is there anything they can do, or what might be some practical ways they might be able to try to start to address that problem?
It's a great question. It goes back to the rule, right? Both the FINRA rule and the BSA are rooted in this notion of a reasonably designed system. And so I think you go back to first principles and say, how are we designing our system? Do we have a reasonable process in place? Can we show that we had thoughtful forecasts about how much we expected to see and how many people would be required? You know, if we knew we were introducing a new functionality like cash management, for example, that might introduce more transactions, did we forecast that and plan for it appropriately? So I think having a process you can point to and a documented, reasonable decision-making mechanism is going to be your best defends your best story. It'll be incumbent on the regulators to recognize that the standard here is reasonableness, not perfection. That's usually the argument you end up having.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I really like that advice about, you know, getting back to having good procedures, because then that also is going to be able to provide you with a baseline for testing. Right. And that's that was another kind of key question that I noticed in that section is, you know, having some ideas about the testing that you're going to be doing. And obviously, if you've got good procedures, you then are going to be executing on those throughout the year. That gives you really good substantive stuff to test once you get to that part.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Yeah. The testing process within your AML program is always going to be a key kind of indicator of health, whether you have a robust testing regimen in place. And when there is an AML hiccup, and there will almost always be AML hiccups, AML is such a technology-driven piece of business that it'll never be perfect. But when you do have a hiccup like that, being able to say, we reasonably tested in a lot of different ways, and the fact that in an array of tests, we did not identify this single hiccup, that doesn't mean our overall system is unreasonable.
Right. Well, another key area that I know seems to be top of mind in not just Finner's report, but I feel like personally, pretty much every single podcast episode I do right now has some kind of cybersecurity tie into it, or at least at some point, it's part of the subject matter that we end up covering. Certainly for FINRA, cybersecurity and technology governance is just such a huge part of, you know, what they're looking for firms to really help enhance their internal compliance programs and related controls inside the firms. When you look at that cybersecurity and technology governance section, you know, were there some of the key things that FINRA mentioned in there that, you know, you think firms would do really well to pay close attention to?
I think the fact that we talk about technology governance as if it's a known thing is already a big indicator of where firms should be worried, because that is a phrase right. that exists, right? Nobody talked right. about that even 4 years ago. And this notion of technology governance and that the business is obligated to supervise the technology, right, I think is a really new concept and one that has not been well built out by the regulators. The regulators would like to say, well, you know, business supervisors, you're in charge, you know, principals of the broker dealer, it's on you to make sure the technology works. Easy to say, very difficult to do. You know, it's not clear at all to anyone what that means in terms of, are principals supposed to be able to review code? Are principals supposed to be able to, you know, understand the what happens when you move to cloud-based technology? That's not realistic. Principals have day jobs. And so I think firms have been focused on and need to continue to focus on the bridge, right, between technology and business supervision. How do you create information flow to make sure that the business supervisors know enough about what's going on to make reasoned, you know, judgments? And how do you make sure that there is, to your point, a testing regimen in place, right? So that there are robust backup procedures to ensure that the technology is working the way the technology is supposed to work, which doesn't necessarily mean testing the code, right? I've worked with enough technology folks now to know that they will test the code before they implement the code. And the code is the code. The code will work. It's a question of testing the real life application of the technology, right? Figuring out what happens if there's an edge case, what happens if this type of event occurs, testing in an environment that simulates real life, I think is part of supervising technology and technology governance.
I think that's such an important point. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I know in talking to lots of other firms, they look at this list and, you know, there are parts of this list that you know, border on some of that technical stuff. That was actually going to be like one of the things I was going to ask you about. Like, you know, they talk about in under the related considerations section under the cybersecurity and technology governance stuff about, you know, what types of penetration testing you're doing, right? And does your firm do a test to web-facing systems? And, you know, how are you monitoring for imposter websites, right? And we all know, I mean, there were a ton of those last year. We got multiple updates. I remember, you know, blast alerts from FINRA saying, hey, don't click on these fake spoof imposter things that are saying they're coming from FINRA, Right. You know, even. And so I guess, you know, maybe another question for you is, with all of the types of testing that's out there, what are some of the best practices that you see on that front? And maybe if there's anything you could add that would give firms peace of mind, you know, as far as the types of testing they can do that'll set them up for success during an examination.
It's a great question. I think some of the things that that people can think about, I guess, as in terms of first principles, I started practicing law a long time ago when email discovery was not a thing, right? You would produce a couple of paper documents and that would be discovery. And then we started sending a lot of emails and lawyers had to produce a lot of emails in different cases. And there was a moment in time where every time a bunch of emails got missed, the lawyers would be like, I don't know, technology. And then at some point the Bar Association got involved and said, lawyers, you need to understand this. You need to own it, right? You need to, we understand it might be technical, but that's not going to be an excuse. And I feel like this is that moment for the business in some ways, where one of the first fundamental principles might be understanding, right? Bridging the gap between technology speak and plain English, which isn't always easy, right? Technologists have a very, very complex and technical way of talking, but understanding what they mean and documenting what they mean in English, right? Documenting what the code is meant to do so that you don't have to go read the code every time you're asked, what are the criteria for this type of event? You know, so some of it is translation. And then some of it, I think, is inventory, understanding what are your systems and how do they interact with each other and what do they do? And if one system changes, what is the ripple effect of that change through other systems? People have started talking in the industry about taking technology inventories for purposes of change management. And I think that's a great exercise, a sort of necessary exercise, if you want to plan out and be thoughtful about, as we change this one widget over here, you know, what does it do to the rest of our system? I think having a documented inventory and flowchart is an important part of that.
Yeah, that's, again, fantastic advice. And another thing that you mentioned there that I just think is so important, and oftentimes, you know, I feel like because, like, and you talked about it at the top when we started talking about cybersecurity, technology governance, like it's kind of an imposing subject matter area. And sometimes it's just really hard for like people to get started. You know, they're like, I don't even know where to begin. You know, and that ultimately it can hurt them a little bit, because then they ultimately don't get started at all. And then, you know, they don't have anything. So I really like your advice about, you know what, like if you can start and just do an inventory of the systems that you have in place, you know, how they relate to one another and what's going to happen if something breaks down with one of them, that will start to hopefully, right, like really force the persons at that firm to think about, again, like all of the things that would happen in a cybersecurity incident or right. Some other kind of disaster recovery, business continuity plan. I mean, all of that stuff that kind of relates to that same related subject matter areas. So another key thing that I saw in the FINRA report that, again, I think, you know, you talked about it a little bit earlier when we were talking about the GameStop, you know, incident that occurred earlier in the year, and the fact that, you know, so many people now are able to trade on their phones, right? So many people are using mobile devices, you know, more than ever to engage in a variety of different things. And I know mobile devices were, you know, mentioned a couple times, you know, throughout the firm. But I guess, you know, in particular, you know, what were some items in the section under mobile devices that really stuck out to you? And I guess just maybe even set the table a little bit, you know, as the industry continues to evolve. And I love that term of art. You've used that a few times today with regard to the evolution of the industry. Maybe what are a couple, not just key things from the FINRA report, but what are maybe a couple key ideas that firms can start to think about so that, you know, they don't become the dinosaur, you know, stuck in the mud here in a year or two, right? That they're able to kind of continue to remain viable in this space.
It's a great question. I mean, I think what we've seen is the enormous adoption, the incredibly quick adoption of mobile devices in terms of people, the way people trade, the way that people manage their investment. They like to be able to check their balance every day on their phone. And I think there is no doubt in my mind that that is the future of the industry, right? That in the same way that I look every day at my bank account balance on my phone and make sure that nobody, you know, has hacked into my bank account, we're going to see the same exact behaviors and the same exact set of expectations. Now, there's a complication there, right? Which is, this isn't simple stuff. And, you know, your phone screen is a pretty small space in which to provide information. And so there is a tension in trying to provide enough information so that people understand what they're looking at without, you know, overcomplicating it to the point where you've lost your audience and they're not going to find your mobile app useful and they're going to go somewhere else. And that is some of the tension here. You know, I think if you're listening to the discussions that have been happening at the SEC, you know, in the second half of last year, when we heard a lot of discussion about the notion of gamification, right? And the use of something like a mobile device to engage customers in this new digital way. And what does that do to a customer's choices, right? Does a mobile device steer a customer in a way that approaches being a recommendation, for example? Those are some of the tensions here, because there are some things about a mobile app that make a lot of sense and aren't part of the traditional broker-dealer model necessarily, unless you were willing to pay a lot of money for it in the past. So for example, on a mobile device, I can tell my broker-dealer app, every time this particular stock XYZ increases by 5%, I want you to tell me, right? And my mobile app will feed me that information. I can get a pop-up. The stock you care about just went up 5%. Is that a recommendation that I should go buy the stock or that I should sell the stock that I have in my account? I think that's a question the regulators would ask. I would argue that if I were rich enough, I might hire an investment advisor who would call me and say, hey, stock XYZ is up 5% today. The mobile app gives everybody access to that level of real-time information. It's funny to me that there is as much concern that it is driving customer behavior when I consider it really to be a great equalizer and sort of providing information to people in a way that to a large group of investors who could not have accessed information in the same way before. But that's the landscape. That's the challenge. That's what makes this innovation so interesting from a regulatory perspective.
That's a really great point. And you've touched on a couple of things that I'd love to dig into a little bit. I mean, we had Neil Matra and we had Jaime Werke. Jaime's with FINRA's Office of Financial Innovation. Yes. Neil is over with SEC's FinHub. They came on the show back in the fall last year, and they were excellent, excellent guests. And one of the things they talked about was gamification in both of their respective units at the SEC and FINRA are doing excellent work and trying to wrap their arms around it. But what you just described is kind of the other, in some ways it rounds out the full context of this gamification issue that I think is so interesting. On the one hand, you know, there are elements of it that some would take the position that it is driving certain types of behavior and the way that it's framed and how you're getting the alerts. On the other hand, what I really like about what you just articulated is like, it does kind of, it helps with the democratization of investing, right? In a way that those applications can also help be the instrument of education and information for your everyday investor that makes investing much more inviting and amenable and accommodating for that retail investor that maybe previously, because they didn't have an investment advisor, because they didn't have somebody that they had hired to represent their account, that they were really gaining access to. That's a really great point. I mean, I just, you know what I mean? It does provide a little bit fuller context there. I mean, that is, and you're right, that is a difficult landscape because there are obviously two very different competing interests there. You know, you want to make sure that people are being provided information and education about the investments and meeting them where they are, which, I mean, let's be honest, much of us are on our phones all the time, is a good place. At the same time, you don't want it to necessarily like drive behaviors that others may not see, I guess, as being helpful, right, or instructive. Right. So, and I guess the other thing, and maybe here's another question for you, you know, that is interesting there, you know, What would you advise firms or with regard to mobile apps and other stuff? Because I know, in addition to, you know, the major broker dealer custodians and other folks that are having their mobile apps, other firms are starting to get in the game too. And I'm just wondering, you know, do you see any record keeping concerns there? Do you see any other types of concerns that may crop up that firms would certainly want to consider before they go down that path?
Your record keeping question is a great question. And it goes back to the point I made at the beginning of our discussion, which is the rules are not written for today's day and age, right? The books and records requirements are written in terms of snapshots, right? You will get an account statement at the end of the month. You will get a confirmation related to this trade. And so the rules are all written for the preservation of specific documentary snapshots. A mobile device is not a snapshot. It's a movie, right? It is constantly changing from moment to moment. And the rules, I don't think, address that in any good way. So are you supposed to be maintaining, you know, if I look at my app during the course of the day and it shows me my account balance, that probably changes every few seconds as the value of some security in my account goes up or down on an exchange. Does that mean that the firm needs to keep a record of every single screenshot that I could look at throughout the period the market is open? That doesn't seem realistic, and I haven't heard any regulator take it that far. But it's a great example of the fact that I don't think many people know exactly how to navigate books and records obligations in light of the very different and innovative ways people are now communicating information to their customers.
Yeah, it's a really insightful take on the mobile experience and how customers are going to be using their phones. And then ultimately, again, like, you go and look at, I mean, again, a strict reading of the rules in place right now. And certainly, you know, there are instances where you're like, do I really need to keep all of those records? Like, how am I, from a resource standpoint, from an operational standpoint, from a logistics standpoint, how is it possible that I'm even going to be able to do that? That's good. Now, thank you for providing some of that additional context.
And there's a real opportunity there for regulators to modernize the requirements, is what I would say.
Yeah. Another area, if I could, I'm going to jump around a little bit, that I think really, you know, struck me is something that I think is, like, you know, it's kind of an older stalwart of the risk and, you know, the examination and risk monitoring programs, but still nonetheless important. And so thought it might be good to, you know, pick your brain on it a little bit, is with regard to best execution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether we're talking about execution quality, whether we're addressing conflicts of interest around order routing, you know, other things like that, I guess, you know, what in that section in particular, you know, in thinking about and drawing from, you know, all the examinations and investigations that you were a part of, you know, what are some key things that on the subject of best execution, you know, FINRA would really be interested in if they came in to kick the tires on your firm?
The answer to that question has changed dramatically, I would say, in the past 15 months.
Okay.
I think if you look at the best ex rule and you look at the best ex case law and the way FINRA has talked about best execution historically, FINRA provided a number of factors that a firm is required to consider when it's assessing whether or not customers are getting best execution. Price is one of the factors, but so is timeliness of execution. So is, you know, the relative opacity of the trade if the customer doesn't want the trade to be, you know, to be broadly seen. So there were a number of factors. Best execution did not equal best price historically. Now, when you're looking at some of the guidance that FINRA has put out, particularly in the past year after GameStop, FINRA is coming pretty damn close to saying that best execution equals best price. And if a firm is not giving the best price to the customer, the firm is failing in its best execution obligations. And that, of course, collides directly with payment for order flow. And, you know, many firms' practices of paying for order flow and providing some level of price improvement, better price, but also providing payment for the order flow that they're receiving. It's an interesting pivot, I think, that FINRA has made. They really are making it very difficult to see a way to get to best execution. I shouldn't say it that way. FINRA is making it sound as though best execution will always require the best price. And that is, I think, a dramatic difference from what they had been saying until very recently.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I would say, you know, just to add even more context, obviously we're focusing on, you know, the FINRA examination and risk monitoring program and its 2022 priorities. Best execution, of course, is always a priority too in the advisor space. And one of the things that I know, even, you know, just in working through best execution, I mean, you know, I was on a quarterly compliance committee meeting earlier today, and one of the topics we were talking about is best execution. And look, we look at a variety of different factors. You know, typically when you're looking at that, it's, you know, it's not just execution price, but, you know, responsiveness. And, you know, there's other factors too. Like, again, depending on the type of security, you know, there are some securities where you're just happy to get a price, like in the fixed income space and other stuff like that, right? Just to be able to have any liquidity is like, yeah, well, that's the best execution for it. So I guess, you know, knowing that it appears as though the seas are shifting a little bit, hoping that maybe we'll get some additional guidance from FINRA and other regulatory bodies that might help provide additional color. So maybe it's not just price, but like what would be advice that you might give firms in the interim as we are kind of looking at this challenge, you know, as we're staring it in the face and they're thinking to themselves, okay, well, if that is the case, what are some things I might be able to do to help better protect my firm?
I think you go back to your regular and rigorous review and making sure that you have a well-documented process to conduct a regular and rigorous review, including looking at things like venues to which you do not route order flow, right? Making sure that you're considering off-exchange trading venues and the pricing available at off-exchange trading venues, not just the NBBO. That seems to be the direction that firms, that FINRA wants firms to move in. And that, I think, would be the best advice I could give to a firm that has felt comfortable with its best execution process and with its regular and rigorous reviews, but now feels that FINRA has changed the rules a bit. I think they have.
Yeah. Well, speaking of changes, one of the things that was new to the report in 2022 was a specific section on trusted contacts. And obviously, some of the stuff that on the subject of trusted contacts, I mean, that has been something that certainly has been espoused for many years. It's not like that idea just started, but I think you continue to see so much attention paid by the industry as a whole. And look, it's great. Because we actually just had Richard Such on with the New Jersey Division of Enforcement a little bit ago, who talked about, you know, seniors and vulnerable investors and what people can do to help protect them. Then actually later NASA did a webinar that was really, really great. Also highlighting not just, you know, some of the issues and the challenges that firms out there are facing, but also, hey, here are some tools and resources that you have available that can help you with that. And so, you know, as it relates to trusted contact persons, you know, have you seen a shift in the industry where, you know, firms absolutely have kind of adopted, right, this idea that for every account or client we're going to get, we're going to make sure to run this down? Or do you still think that maybe some firms need a little bit of a push to get there?
I think the firms that I've seen working on this are working assiduously to collect this information and are committed to protecting senior investors. So it's hard to find people that would say, no, we don't want to protect the senior investors who may be vulnerable. I think that there are challenges in getting information from people. I always say to people, I plan to be a little old lady one day, and I would like to make my own decisions when I am. And so there is, I think, a real conflict in getting information from customers and saying, if we decide that you require our protection, we're going to reach out to this other person and get them involved. I think firms have some real challenges in trying to get that information from their customers.
You're exactly right. And those conversations, because they are so personal, can be really difficult to have. You know, we oftentimes we get questions around, okay, well, you know, I'm kind of hitting a brick wall, you know, I'm not really getting so far. And they'll ask for ideas about how they can broach the subject. I mean, one that we've used in the past is, oh, you know, hey, we're doing, you know, an annual review of different accounts, and we came across yours, and we were going to try to find, you know, a way that we could get to meet with you. You know, we weren't able to connect with you. Is there somebody else that, you know, that you're really close with that you're able to, that you are around frequently, or that helps you with this kind of stuff? Someone else that might be able to like help us get in touch with you from time to time and broach it in a softer way like that. Sometimes that can at least spark a conversation towards it, but I don't know, what are some ideas that you have or that you've seen that might be helpful in that regard?
I think you're exactly right when you say these can be very personal conversations. And so I think that some of the trick in getting information from customers is having that relationship, having a common sense conversation, depending on the nature of the relationship between the broker and the customer. The other thing I wouldn't lose sight of is that the rule requires reasonable efforts. And so if you're making reasonable efforts and the customer has declined to give you information, you have met your obligations under the rule. And so I kind of go back to documenting what efforts you made, making sure that you can demonstrate that you did try to get the information, probably on multiple occasions, making sure that you have the other basic forms of blocking and tackling also in place. So you have procedures, written supervisory procedures that you know, provide a structure for requesting the information and making sure you have, you know, a way to use the information if you have it. Making sure you have training. You know, I think some of the effective practices that FINRA lays out in its priorities are not requirements, but demonstrate what I think are very good faith efforts by a lot of different firms to protect senior investors. And that's really what this rule comes down to, and FINRA's prioritization of this rule. FINRA wants to demonstrate that it and the industry value senior investor protection.
Such a what a great approach and a great reminder to everyone, to all the listeners of this podcast, whether it's, and this is both, I mean, that advice is fantastic for a couple of reasons. One, certainly on the subject of trusted contacts, you know, you as a firm want to make sure you're taking reasonable steps to try to get that information. But ultimately, you can't force people, your clients, to do something that they don't want to do. But if you can show that record, if you can show that audit trail and substantiate that you took the proper steps, you followed your firm's procedures, you still didn't get anything, that's so important. And I'm sure, you know, when you sat on the other side of the table, I know in the audits that I've been a part of with FINRA and the SEC, anytime as a firm, right, you say what you do and do what you say, right? So then, you know, you follow that. It does. It speaks volumes in those examinations, and it goes such a long way to building credibility with the staff, the examination staff, both, you know, for FINRA, but I'll even expand it and go further out to the SEC and other regulatory bodies where if you are able to demonstrate that kind of audit trail, you really do gain a lot of credibility with the regulators, and that can be so effective during an examination of your firm.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly right.
Susan, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for all of your insights. I know, you know, this report is often used by so many broker-dealer firms to really be a guide, you know, a roadmap, provide guidelines for them that are they're gonna be looking at throughout the year. You've shared some really valuable insights for our listeners. I will say thank you on their behalf and my own. Thanks again for coming on today's show, and look forward to having you back. Oh, I almost forgot the fun question. So we usually like to end something, you know, we've talked a lot of shop today, but maybe if we move away from the technical a little bit, you know, we're still kind of in the winter months. You know, I know here in Cincinnati, we had like a brief snippet of like what spring might be like. And then now we're back slammed with cold again. So as people maybe gear up for the next, you know, 6 to 8 weeks where it's still a little cold outside, what's maybe a really great TV show or movie you've seen recently, or maybe a really great book that you've read that our listeners might want to dig into?
I'm trying to think about something that I've read that is not work related.
Yeah.
Let's think. Yeah.
Yeah, just a little light reading of FINRA Rule 3310. You know how it
basically that's what it comes down to. I know. Surely I could think of something. I just watched. What did I just watch? Oh, you know what? This is ridiculous. This is how behind the times I am. My 15-year-old daughter and I have just been watching Arrested Development for the first time. Never watched it. And she keeps asking me, like, is that a case you would be involved in?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Involved in that. Yeah, that's fantastic. That is a great recommendation. I know, especially when, you know, perfect for binge watching now that you can stream it on a couple of different services. I may actually, you've sparked now in my head, I may have to get back into that because I've got kiddo number three arriving here later this year. So I'm probably going to have plenty of time at home to maybe do some of that. But no, again, thank you so much for coming on today's show. Really, really appreciate your incredibly valuable insights and look forward to having you back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thanks so much. This is a lot of fun.
The final part of today's show features another segment of History Has Your Back. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents the part of the podcast where we go back in time to help us better understand the present and help define where we're headed in the future. There is a quote made famous in Volume 7 of the Bruce Lee memoir, Striking Thoughts, edited and written by Bruce Lee and John Little, which states, quote, "Don't fear failure. Not failure, but low aim is the crime. In great attempts, it is glorious even to fail," end quote. For anyone that has deeply examined the life of Bruce Lee, I think it's more than fair to say that he was a remarkable figure. But like any good compliance nerd, I really wanted to dig deep on the credibility of the quote I saw and substantiate its history and, of course, discuss how maybe we can apply it to our compliance programs. From the blog Sourcing Bruce Lee, there was an article from September 2021 that reviewed this exact topic and offered some excellent considerations. As it turns out, a couple quick Google book searches reveal that a version of this quote has been popular for centuries. The 1857 book, The Works of Professor Wilson of the University of Edinburgh, Volume 8, Essays, Critical and Imaginative, contains an essay about Greek drama that also contains a very specific sentence we were just talking about. It states, quote, "In greatest attempts, it is indeed glorious even to fail," end quote. And even further back than that, we can actually trace the following quote to the British periodical The Adventure, published in 1754, where it states, quote, "In brave attempts, it is glorious even to fail," end quote. The author of the blog goes on to say that in addition to the above sources, it's even further possible that Bruce Lee may have even heard this quote from Vince Lombardi, who was apparently famous for saying the quote and even received some attribution for it. Long story short, a couple things stand out to me here. Number one, in an age of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Snapchat, TikTok, Pinterest, Reddit, YouTube, and WhatsApp, just to name a few, it's important to remember that just because somebody created a meme, slapped on a quote, and provided attribution doesn't necessarily make it true. As compliance officers, I'm sure many of us have seen variations of this type of situation via unsubstantiated claims inside our firms. Looking at you, marketing. And it's important to keep our radars up to try and arrive at the proper source in all situations. The second thing that I kind of took away from this is, regardless of who said it first, there is wisdom in these words for compliance officers. Compliance gets tagged with some negative stigmas all the time. But as we've said on this show many, many times, ultimately, compliance is about elevating the services our firms provide their clients. Enhancing and elevating our services inherently means that we're not perfect to start. And sometimes there may be instances where a failure occurs. That doesn't mean the compliance program failed. Quite the contrary, identification and remediation of the failure demonstrates a very healthy compliance program, and firms and compliance officers should take some peace of mind that failure may occur, particularly in those instances where we are attempting to do better. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calfee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Susan Schroeder, for providing her keen insights on the 2022 report on FINRA's examination and risk monitoring program. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on Twitter using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.